talk a minute about bibliography, because some of you have said that you want to do more reading, and some of you have never been here during the whole course, and you're laughing, you're quite right, have suddenly put in an appearance for this occasion. Perhaps they read, even if they don't listen. Hope so. Anyway, the question is, therefore, that I will only give you books in English. I think the rest is wasted time on my part, and on your part, and it's not something you will want to read in any. The best book on what I have been talking about lately, that is to say, the beginning of the Holocaust and the Holocaust. In fact, the standard work is a work by Raoul Hilbert called The Destruction of the European Jews. This work by Raoul Hilbert on the destruction of the European Jews is standard and enormous. You will not want to read it. It isn't a book one reads, but it is a book that is authoritative in anything that you want to know about it. As far as the concentration camps are concerned, and the internal of the concentration camps, and the controversy about it, one book is Bruno Bettelheim, The Informed Heart, which some of you, I think, have already read, perhaps in another connection or in another course. The thesis that I have been following about the camps is also supported by Bettelheim and by another book on the concentration camps by a man called Cohen, which is on the psychology of the concentration camps, it's called. It is actually less good on this point of view than Bettelheim.
What's the name of the
Bettelheim? The Informed Heart. The Informed Heart. You've heard of a heart. Maybe you haven't. The Informed Heart, it's called. The Book of the Displaced Persons, which is another thing altogether, and I think probably the best book on the displaced persons proper, is by Yehuda Bauer, and it's called Flight and Rescue. Flight and Rescue by Yehuda Bauer. They exist on that same problem, an earlier book, published in 1949 by Schwartz, called The Redeemers. Not so familiar with the Bauer book, but the Bauer book is, I'm familiar with his work, the Bauer book is probably much superior to the Schwartz book, The Redeemers, which is partly very sentimental and is published in 1949. Now, here you have to make a distinction, which I want to mention right here. In the end, the displaced persons were made up of two groups, not one. One group is the people who came out of the concentration camps. And the other group, which is equally large, and perhaps even larger, is the group that was repatriated by the Soviet Union to Poland. In Poland, you have immediately the repatriation staff from the Soviet Union. These were people who 39 had fled to the Soviet territory. Immediately, they are repatriated to Poland. You get a pogrom in Poland, a Kielce, in 1946. So that about 150,000 Jews who were repatriated by the Soviet to Poland, with the pogroms that immediately started up again in Poland, fled to West Germany. And by 1946-47, they make up the bulk, really, of what we call the displaced persons, and probably the most creative part of them. That is to say, they, perhaps with the people who came from the camps, started out groups, mostly Zionist groups. Mostly Zionist groups. Both the people from the camps and these DPs who came from the east started up some very important Zionist groups. But that is not important now. The Bauer book is mostly, I take it, about those who fled from Poland and who came into Germany, West Germany, and then went on either to Israel or to the United States. The most moving book about the concentration camp experience, Witness Schultz, is a book by Saul Friedlander, and it is on a particular episode, but it is on a very famous episode. And the book is called, it's a biography, of Kurt Gerstein. Now, Kurt Gerstein, it's in English. Kurt Gerstein was, well, a very complicated individual, but at the time, an SS man, and indeed a supplier of the gas for the gas chambers. He was concerned with that. And he looked at the camps and first saw the camps, and he was the man who really revealed what went on. Afterwards, he tried to see the papal nuncio in Berlin and so on, until his arrest for telling and publicizing what went on in the camp. So Kurt Gerstein is a very, in many ways, problematic, but in other ways, a rather heroic figure. Those of you who have seen the play, The Deputy, by Hohut when it was playing in New York, will realize that Gerstein plays a central role in that play. So Friedlander's Gerstein is about this episode of this very complicated individual who in the end tried to reveal to the world what went on. Three other books should be mentioned in this regard. The Cuts, Black Sabbath is on your reading list. It is the only Marxist analysis we have of this episode at all, and it is a rather fascinating one. I don't agree with many people that it is that mistaken. I think it is probably perfectly true. The Cuts, Black Sabbath, which is a Marxist analysis, as some of you know. The other book we tried to get you to read, I don't know if it's still on your thing, but which is a novel, and I think it may be in print again one of these days, is Schwarzbart, The Last of the Just, which is an extremely good novel because it gives you extremely well the atmosphere. The atmosphere both in Germany under the Nazis and after that. It is a very moving novel. The most controversial book about all of this, which you have also read in another connection, is Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem. Now, I must tell you, first of all, that that book isn't written in the heavy style you are accustomed to, because these were New Yorker articles, and the New Yorker rewrote the whole thing. So it isn't so bad reading as what you had to read, which the New Yorker did not rewrite for them. It is very controversial, as you will soon see if you read it in connection with the course, because in effect an attack not only on the Jewish Council, but on the whole behavior of the Jews in that situation. And I would say what I said when I reviewed it originally, that she's extremely good on the Nazis, extremely good. She is less good on the Jews, much less good. But she is also very good what happened with the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem. This I know firsthand, and on that she is very good. That is to say, the kind of collaboration you had between Ben-Gurion and the German government, probably justified, but she's good at it. So I recommend it. Now, the book which gives you again in a factual way the whole of the Nazi policy from 1933 to 1938, that is to say, really, until the Nazi policy in a way changed, is a book by a man called Karl, again in English, Karl Schleuders, which will make it easy for you if you're interested to, it's It's more or less factual, but to recapture the kind of Jewish policy that I talked about. The title is The Twisted Road to Auschwitz, 1933-1939. It's not as sensational as the title. The Twisted Road to Auschwitz, 1933-1939, an excellent discussion of Nazi Jewish policy until 1939, and you know what that means. As far as fascism in general is concerned, the Jewish question is very well integrated in a rather new book on that subject by Alastair Hamilton, indeed 1971, called The Appeal of Fascism. And in this book by Hamilton of 1971, where he discusses why fascism appealed to intellectuals and others, the Jewish question is very well integrated. What I might call the standard work on the European right as a whole is a collection of essays edited by Weber and Rogge, called The European Right. Now, this book, which you can get in paperback, Hilberg is in paperback. The European Right takes you through the rightist regimes in Europe from 1918 onwards, and has therefore much on the Jewish question. It has excellent articles, above all, on the right in Romania, which I've talked about somewhat, the right in Hungary, which I have also talked about somewhat. But these are especially good, but it goes through the entire right. For the Nazis, I want to recommend to you the current Playboy. I never thought I'd recommend Playboy to you. But the current Playboy has something in it which I urge you to read. You can skip the pictures, which are interesting anyhow. You've seen better yourself. So then, in the current Playboy, there is an interview with Albert Speer. That is most of the Playboy, as far as I could gather. Albert Speer, who was Hitler's architect, munitions minister, and closest to Hitler, as you know, of all his entourage. It is a long interview. It goes into such matters I have talked about, like depersonalization. And as Speer is really the executor of the Nazi myth and Nazi mythology, what he has to say is extremely illuminating and will fit in excellently. However, if this summer you have time, and with the employment situation the way it is, you will, I wish you would look at his book, which has been a bestseller, as you know, justifiably for this time, called Inside the Third Reich. Never mind the sensational title. You can get it in pocketbook. It is the best book ever to give you the flavor of Hitler and his entourage. There's nothing like Speer's book to give you the flavor of Hitler and his entourage, because he goes into the dinners, the lunches, the whole thing in some detail. So Speer's book, Inside the Third Reich, I would say now, is certainly the best book on National Socialism that we have, and in a sense, what it was really like. Now, finally, if there are some of you who are interested in demography and in post-war Jewish demography and things of this nature, Jewish population, Jewish flight, and Jewish rescue, there is a book by Mark Vishnitzer called To Dwell in Safety. But this book, which is a very early one, 1948. This book by Mark Vishnitzer, To Dwell in Safety, is very good, above all, on what I would call the demography of the Jewish situation after 1948. Now, obviously, the literature on Nazi National Socialism is vast and constantly growing. And the books that I have given you are only those which concern themselves more or less directly with the Jewish question in the English language. I must say again something I have said before, that the best literature on the Jewish question in all of this aspect is not in English. You run into a problem which is an interesting problem. The English Jewish community and the American Jewish community are basically not very intellectual. And for that reason, you have hardly any support in America or England for the writing of modern Jewish history. But you have a lot of support in it, of course, for example, for obvious reasons, in Germany, in Israel, to a certain extent, not that much. In Israel, in Germany above all, but to a certain extent in France. The result of that is that the best literature is either written in Israel, which is very spotty, but as I say, the best thing on the Bund in English is Ezra Mendelssohn's Class Struggle in the Bund. That's very good. So it's either written in Israel in English, and there's very little about it, very little. And or it is written in German, and of that there is very much and of very, very high quality. That doesn't mean it's written by Germans, but it's published in Germany, in German. It's mostly, now more and more work is done by young German scholars, but before that it was refugees, other professors from elsewhere, and the answer is that Germany was the only place you could get that sort of thing published. Therefore, what you have in Germany is the best literature. And if any of you want to know about it and read German, please ask me, and I will be glad to give you some. As for France, things are dismal. There isn't a great deal in France. There is some, but really very little indeed. For example, the best book on French Jews I gave you some time ago is Michael Maris's. I've forgotten the title now. Well, The Politics of Assimilation, and that is written, of course, by a Canadian professor at the University of Toronto, and not by a Frenchman. In France, things look very thin as well. Again, we're dealing with a Jewish community that isn't very intellectual. You can say other nasty things about the French Jewish community, and I'll be glad to see them all. Because I suffered under them. Now, just a minute. This is then roughly situation. And what you have therefore are these books, and I hope that you will do further reading, because many things, like the whole concentration camp DP thing, are very complicated, very controversial, and you should read about it. If you read Bettelheim, read Bauer, all of that thing you should do. Now, I said today, otherwise, I would open it up to questions. Now, according to your will, as hesitatingly expressed the last time, you may remember, you wanted something today and something Friday. So let me say again, before I throw it open to questions, that you will get your take home on Friday. And if you're not here to get it, that's tough. We're not going to look for you. That may be very tough for those who have barely discovered this room. So, on Friday, please remember, a week from today, you will get your take home examination. I don't know what arrangements we've made for giving them back on the 3rd. Have we, David? What arrangements we've made for giving back the final, but we'll let you know about it. Now, have you filled out these forms? Have you all finished filling them out? Then I'll give you some time right now, 5 minutes before I answer the question. Please get a form.
Yes.
Or perhaps I should wait till the end, probably. That was a silly idea. Oh. You like everything to go smooth? No, it never gets smooth. Well, I'll wait with it to the end, I think. Otherwise, I just create chaos. But if you don't have it, please get it. All right, then. I will throw it up. I will throw it open to any questions that you might now have. Fine. Yes, I can't see anybody if I'm blocked. Yes.
I think you left out the recording something that this that is put by David Robinson.
Oh, yes. Yeah, let me say something about that. I didn't put it in, I should have, but that is my old prejudice against it. Jacob Robinson, "The Crooked Shall Be Made Straight," is essentially a Robinson, just the ordinary Robinson. Jacob Robinson, "The Crooked Should Be Made Straight," is a detailed answer to Hannah Arendt. That's what it is, actually. It is the best defense of the Judenrate, so-called defense, I mean that, of the Judenrate. And I think, I'm glad you mentioned it, because all of you, from what I said last time, were probably hostile to these people, because it's difficult to put yourself into this situation. I think for that, Robinson is excellent, the more I think about it. My reservations of Robinson are simply some other reservations, both some materials used and his whole slant, I find disagreeable. But that's neither here nor there. I think as a defense of the Judenrate, or an explanation against Hannah Arendt's attack, it is very good. But you can make your own judgment. When he goes beyond the Judenrate, I personally agree with Arendt much more than I agree with him. But that you can judge for yourself. Unfortunately, that is again a big book. But though it is a big book, the Judenrate chapters are rather separate. And you can read the chapters on the Jewish councils without going into the rest, which is very detailed, and you may not want to do. So don't be put off that it is so big. It has the chapter on the Jewish councils. Yes? You must have something to ask about the course. Yeah?
You mentioned last week this resistance.
Yeah.
What resistance came too late, and that the really crucial point was over the issue of deportation, and that at that point, that they should have resisted not.
I never said they should have, because I think that would be arrogant.
Okay, that was the point at which, you know, it came too late.
Yeah.
Now, why didn't they, or what were the circumstances that led them not to resist the war on something, you know, clearly?
Well, you mustn't forget about deportation and several things. You mustn't forget the basic thing that I tried to stress, the kind of embourgeoisement. I mean, you were asked to report. The way it worked, you were asked to report at a certain place, yes? Which was the gathering place. Now, to be sure, some people didn't report, but if you didn't report, you were certainly executed. I mean, there was no doubt about it. The second thing you must remember, that it was not reporting for extermination. That was never used. It was reporting for resettlement. And in such a situation, I don't know whether you've ever been in an extreme situation, optimism prevails. I mean, I can only really explain it by going to cancer. If you have cancer, we know people who've had cancer. And till the last moment, they are somehow optimists. Optimism, resettlement prevails. Now, this, however, is not totally true, because the situation I know best, the situation in Berlin, for example, the following happened, that the SS in charge of collection and deportation, the Berlin SS, whenever there was a deportation, which happened about 3 or 4 times a week, got deadly drunk and quite incapable, because they knew. And by 1944, the Berlin SA had to be SS had to be replaced by SS from Austria, who were more fanaticized. I mean, whatever you hear about the nice Austrians, that's of course propaganda. The most fanaticized Nazis did not come from Berlin, they came from Austria. So the Berlin SS was replaced, so they knew. I think there is also, by 1942-43, a very good indication that some people in the Berlin Jewish community knew, or at least guessed, or something like that, because I know some people who were concerned in these lists and in these deportations. Now, in Berlin, and in towns like that, a lot escaped, at least 5,000. Who were hidden in Berlin, as I told you last time. And when the 5,000 escaped, who were hidden, they escaped then. They escaped at that moment. That was the moment. That's what I meant to say. However, in Eastern Europe, it was quite different, because there you already had the ghettos. There was no rounding up, in the sense, in Berlin. There you were simply taken from the ghetto because you were already rounded up, if you like. And there, of course, this did not apply. And what you get instead are resistance movements in the ghetto itself. But there you were already cohesive. And as I said last time, that when the Nazis instituted the ghetto, they did it as a convenience. But oddly enough, they never thought that for the first time they gave the Jews a cohesion which would make resistance a possibility. And of course, they soon found out, don't you see? For the first time, in other words, the ghetto for the Nazis turned to be our very two-edged sword. But in Berlin, in Paris, in the other places, in Rome, as you know from your Cuts book, this did not maintain. The Jews were scattered over the town, and they were all collected. So that in that case, escape is possible, and was possible. Look at the Cuts book. Most of the Roman Jews escaped. That was quite possible, because you got a notice. So most escaped. In Berlin, 5,000 escaped. And there were only, by that time, perhaps 10, 15, 20,000 Jews left in Berlin. You mustn't forget that either. So it was possible at that time, yes, but not in Eastern Europe, not in the ghettos, only where deportation was a rounding up. Does that explain it? Only there. And there it was. And indeed it took place. Yes?
Suffering anything after Warsaw ghetto or Brussels?
No. Not in detail. But we hadn't dealt with it, that's why. We will cover in the exam what we've dealt with, not what we haven't dealt with. Yeah?
You didn't make clear in the last lecture, you were talking about the youth rate of getting the orders.
Yes. Yeah.
How much they knew, or whatever, if that was sort of left ambiguous.
Yes. Now, that is, I mean, let us distinguish against two things. You always have to have chronology in here, you see. Now, obviously, in Theresienstadt, they knew what was happening to people who were deported from Theresienstadt to an extermination camp. I would say, without doubt. But in the Warsaw Ghetto, the diary has now been published of the chief of the Judenräte in the Warsaw Ghetto. And he certainly had an idea. Yes. Yes. And in the end, he knew. He committed suicide in the end. You have a lot of suicides on the Judenräte in the end, which meant that they knew and they just couldn't take it anymore. Yes? The Judenräte in Hungary undoubtedly knew in the end, I mean not even in the end, what was happening. But at first, I would say up to 1940, no, not particularly, because nothing particularly organized was really happening. No. And when they knew, I mean again, it was very difficult to know what to do. Because what you must not forget, Walter, is that their rationalization, I give it to you, straight. It's very simple. At times, the Nazis let them reduce the lists. Now, for the Nazis, they were going to exterminate everybody. But to make the Judenräte more compliant, at times they would say, yes, we see your argument, we will strike 20, 30, 50 people from the deportation list. As far as they were concerned, because they couldn't look into the future, those were 20, 30 people saved. So you come again into a dilemma, which is historical and general. Is it worth collaborating to save lives? And before you answer that rationally, you better think about it. Is it worth collaborating even to save a single life? That Hannah Arendt completely forgets, actually. Completely. Isn't it worth collaborating? Now, as a matter of fact, they did save lives, because the Nazis never ended the process, and quite a few people escaped. Now, the reverse side was it. Whom did the Judenräte exempt from the list? Most of them were honest people, but the temptation to exempt from the list your immediate relatives was, of course, overwhelming and totally understandable. There's only one major case where we know this was done. That is by Kästner in Hungary. And he did it. The Hungarians allowed certain trains of Jews to go out. People who were saved, and the Judenräte did this more or less. People who were saved, one, I think, two trainloads to get out. And Kästner put his whole family on one train. And he was eventually, as you may know, assassinated in Israel by somebody who lost all his family, which wasn't on the train. But again, I must come back, don't pass judgments. Better not to pass judgments than to pass judgments hurriedly on these affairs. The pressure to put your own loved ones and to save their lives was overwhelming. And how many great men are there? There are not very many great men. There were more great men in those days than there are in our day, that's for sure. So you must not forget this. To not do this, you really had to have a tremendous strength of character. And these people were ordinary people like your parents. Like me. I'm not claiming I would have had the strength of character.
In your presentation on the extermination camps, I was particularly struck by the fact that you omitted certain things. Would you care to say a few words now on the anguish of those people who were killed? Because it just seemed to me that...
That I assume. We all know about it. We're dealing here with history, and that is all. Whatever the anguish were, what I am concerned with is how it was done, the system, the resistance to the system. The anguish, what does one need to talk about? We are all agreed on that. We know all about that. We cannot imagine it in any case. It transcends imagination. It's bad to talk about something that transcends imagination. Now, to be sure, what you mean is that one has become inured to mass killings. Quite correct. I think that started in European history with the Japanese invasion of Manchuria, which in fact I would say is a odd kind of prelude to the Jewish extermination. Because you weren't alive, but for years one heard the Japanese have bombed and killed 1 million Chinese, 400 Chinese, 500,000 Chinese. And one became quite inured to this. I think that's a very important episode in this kind of becoming inured to mass killing, which is, of course, a phenomenon in modern times. It is a phenomenon. And the anguish of the people killed is obvious. I don't really know what you want me to say about that. I know how it worked. I know what happened. But what do you want me to say about the anguish? There's really nothing I can add to that.
Well, there are varieties of it.
As people did not leave their memoirs, how can one tell? As I've tried to make clear to you, the killing was done totally impersonally. And it is even probable, very probable, that most people who went into the gas chambers did not know they were going to be killed. That you must not forget.
I'm asking a methodological question, which is, if you're approaching this from the vantage point of mass psychology or
mass social.
Well, that's what we've done in a way.
Doesn't that have a built-in insensitivity to the masses who go through their deaths?
I don't know what you mean insensitivity.
It has this built-in aloofness. And,
well, I don't know really what you mean by that. I'm very puzzled. All historical discussion has a built-in aloofness, obviously. Because you're dealing with phenomena as historical phenomena. That's what you're doing. So it has a built-in aloofness. What the people felt, we shall never know. We do know what people felt to escape, because they wrote about it and told us about it. But it is certain that the people who went into the gas chambers, it's less certain about the previous means I described, never really knew what was happening. Have to remember, you haven't been to Dachau or to Theresienstadt. These things were very cleverly disguised. You mustn't forget, it said a sign, this way to the bathhouse and everything like that. They were very cleverly disguised. And people have a tremendous capacity of fooling themselves. In an extreme situation, that capacity is, of course, overwhelming. You must put that in. So your question will never be answered. Will never be answered. What effect it had on Jewish history, to that I shall come next week. Yeah.
In 1933 to 1939 in Germany, the Germans did know what was going on with the Jews. Am I safe to presume they knew basically that, I'm not talking about mass extermination, but they knew that the Jews...
Well, I mean, that's a funny question, Mr. Nathanson. There were benches in parks for Jews only. There were seats in tram cars for Jews only. Of course they knew.
Then your association that you made with the dorms to say the situation, if they just called with you, the government came in and took a few, can't there be more guilt than that, a period of 6 years?
No.
To just take that association?
No, because there was a lot of psychological preparation, which you've read in the crisis. And as long as no Jew was physically harmed, I'm sorry to tell you, most people didn't care whether they sat on separate benches. And they probably thought that the elimination from the profession was rather a good thing, because it made room for other people to step in a bad and depressed economic situation. No. Remember, this is before civil rights, before the civil rights movement, or even before any excitement about civil rights in that zone. The Jews simply became the American Negroes. And you are an American. Who cared about that at those times? Very few. Yeah.
You talked about the organization of deportation, you stressed the role played by the Jewish Council.
Yeah.
What about the role played by the natives in this country? Now, Eric, I think you're quite differentiated, you can say, Norway and Bulgaria. Oh,
yes. No. Yes, no. I'm not talking about that. I didn't talk about Norway, Denmark. Because you know what happened in Denmark. The Danes spirited away the Jews. They did it because, and they could do it, because in Denmark you have a peculiar situation. The peculiar situation, not only the cohesion and, in a sense, the deep Protestant Christianity of the population, but also a very peculiar Nazi occupation. The man who was in charge of the occupation of Denmark, Dr. Best, is a very odd figure. Dr. Best was not originally a Nazi, he became an early Nazi, but a very peculiar kind of Nazi. And indeed, it could not have been done without the acquiescence, the passive acquiescence of Best and his second in command, whose name I've forgotten, but he is now actually the German ambassador to Denmark, and I've forgotten his name. That second in command warned the Jews of what was going to happen. They got an order, and they always did it, from Berlin. Jews are to be deported on this day and that. And there was usually some 2 weeks lead time to organize it. And at that point, the second in command of the Nazi occupation, whose name, I'm sorry, just escapes me, with Best's acquiescence, that's why Best was never convicted after the war, warned the Jewish population, and not only that, some leading Danes. And of course, Denmark's geographic situation was such that Jews could be spirited away, right? In Norway, the matter is complicated by this, that the Nazis imposed on Norway a singularly unpopular government, the government of Quisling, yeah? And that Norway is again, like Yugoslavia, excellent guerrilla and hiding territory by its very geographical thing. And that the Norwegians, of course, to a man, were hostile to the occupation, you see? And again, I would put something up to a deep Protestant Christianity, because while many Hungarians, Romanians, or Balkan people may have been hostile to the Germans, they did absolutely nothing. Of course, there's a long history of anti-Semitism there. And perhaps I should say that there is no history of anti-Semitism in Norway and Denmark, at least none that I know of. That's important too. There is no history of anti-Semitism in those countries. Not in Sweden either, for that matter. There is no history. So these are peculiar situations. You see what I mean? But the interesting thing is why it happened there, not in the Balkans. Well, there's a history of anti-Semitism, and of right-wing activity and all of that, which we've talked about. So it could happen there, but not there. You see what I mean? And I don't have the figures of Norwegian deportation. I'm not even sure how many Jews there were in Norway. It can't have been an overwhelming number, somehow. And I don't have the figures, but that's what Hilberg is for. Hilberg has all the data on all of that, on all of that. And you'll have to look it up in Hilberg, how many Jews in Norway there were and what actually happened in Norway, which I'm really not that familiar with.
I'd like to say something about your statement last time that the people who survived the camps were human corpses. That statement out of Bethlehem is, I think, totally wrong, and I think you set the record very wrong. The people who survived the camps, numbering about 90,000
in
all, were, in the weeks after their liberation, in a state of what might be described as demoralization, as traumatized apathy, but not anything that you would call unhuman.
You mean not permanent?
This is true. And not even from the beginning. I think the evidence that we can show to that is the following. 3 days after the liberation of Buchenwald, which was the last, the first camp liberated on April 11th,
right.
3 days afterwards, there was a publication, handwritten.
Yes.
Called on the Jewish survivors
to
deny political organization for their speedy immigration to Palestine.
Yes.
I know. 2 months after, on June 9th, there was a meeting in Munich called by the survivors to organize such an organization. The ideology of that was something very new in Jewish life, that is, it was against the parties.
Yes.
That's a very important development.
Let me just say about this. I think you're right. And I didn't mean to put it this strongly. What happened probably is the people revived, some didn't, as you know, and are still in Israel and hospitals and things like that. But surely, many survived, and there were movements which came out of that. Almost entirely, it must be said, of course, Zionist. Entirely Zionist. That was the consequence which they drew. And they had meetings of that sort after a time. Now here the evidence is conflicting, and I wish that you, all of you, would read the evidence yourself. One evidence is this, the other evidence is Bauer, or you may add something to it, but it's mostly newspaper form and not so well. Is there another book they can read on that?
Well, there's some stuff in Yiddish.
Yeah, well, they don't read Yiddish, so that's no good, I'm afraid.
Ours is the best.
Yeah. So I would say again, we come into something here that we come into all the time in this course, and that is things just haven't been researched through. It would be an excellent research, an excellent thesis to make do a scholarly and single work on this subject, you know, taking all the theses into consideration. But I don't want to dwell on that so much if you have some other more central topical questions. I do want to tell you that though I know this interests you most, it is again a product of all Jewish past history, as you will see, and the final examination will cover all of the past history and will not in any special way go into this in a very special or, you know, specially emphasized way. Let me make that quite clear, because you might get the idea that the final examination will be about the Holocaust. It won't be about the Holocaust. It'll be about a lot of things, but the whole course. That, I think, I must make quite clear to you. Now I give you some time to fill out the form. When you fill it out, please give it to one of us, will you? Please give it to one of us.